Homosexuality. The eighth talk in a series titled Sodom and Sexual Purity was presented by Jack Crabtree on February 25, 2003, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
A lot of different directions that we could go. What I've decided, I think, is the most important at our time and place in our society today is to try to give a perspective from the standpoint of biblical faith and biblical Christianity on the morality of homosexuality. We can go into some other topics in our discussion later if you want to, if there's something that I'm not covering that is an issue for you. But it just seems to me that there's a lot of confusion and not much clarity in our culture today about the ethics, the morality of homosexuality, and so that's what I want to address right up front. I remember not too many years ago, we had some guests come two lesbians during one of those initiative debates when, I don't remember which one it was, Measure 13 or Measure whatever. And I was trying to make the point that it was far more important to me from the standpoint of the laws of our land that we have our laws clearly and unambiguously define homosexuality as perverse than that we try to take health benefits and insurance benefits and stuff like that away from homosexual couples. That it's a far more important issue, it seems to me, what kind of moral perspective and what kind of moral judgment we codify in our law. That's far more important than whether or not people are somehow penalized or deprived or something like that for being homosexuals. And that didn't go over real well. But it became very clear in that conversation that it wasn't at all clear what the Christian perspective on life and reality was. Because for me, to call homosexuality perverse is, okay, yeah, right. But I call lots of things perverse. Lying is perverse. Deception is perverse. Failing to love people that ought to be loved is perverse. Our whole lives are a perversity, are a distortion, are a deprivation of the humanity that God wanted us to have. So on the one hand, that's serious. On the other hand, for us who really live and breathe a biblical worldview, to call something perverse is sort of fairly ordinary, fairly mundane, because we really believe that. We really believe that this is a broken world that we live in. But that's what's become lost today, is the whole idea that it would even be at all a possibility, that it would even be a viable option to call homosexuality perverse, has been completely lost in our culture today. And that's what I want to talk about a little bit. A little brief history of attitudes toward homosexuality. I think it's fair to say that homosexuality has always been there. Even in times of tremendous moral virtue, where moral virtues were held in high esteem, I think it's fair to say that homosexuality was always there. It's interesting that in the Mosaic Covenant, there are laws against homosexual activity. Well, presumably God has a law against it because there was a possibility that somebody would violate it. There's a possibility that somebody would be inclined to engage in homosexual activity. So I think it's probably likely that it's always been there. People point to something like Plato and argue that, well, look, here's a culture that just took it for granted. And I don't know if you've read much Plato, but in the pages of the Platonic Dialogues, you have bantering back and forth about love relationships between an older man and a younger man. It's not even the homosexuality of our culture. It was a whole another institution where it was sort of a mentor-disciple relationship that involved sexuality at the same time. And that seems to be rather taken for granted, and there's sort of a casual, cavalier attitude toward it. So somebody could read that and see that as this whole other culture there that had no problem with a certain manifestation of homosexuality. I don't think that's right for two reasons. In the dialogue that talks about it the most, Plato's dialogue in the Symposium, in one of the speeches, one of the speakers, I don't remember which one it is, but one of the speakers makes reference to how there are those people out there who think that this love that we are singing praises to is evil, immoral, wrong, bad, whatever. And that seems to be supported by the laws, because as I understand it, many of the Greek city-states actually had laws on the books against homosexuality. So while it was being practiced by this group of people that are reflected in the Platonic dialogues, on the one hand, on the other hand, it's not clearly and unambiguously an accepted cultural phenomenon in ancient Greece. It just isn't. My theory, my own personal theory, is that what we find in the culture of the Platonic dialogues is the kind of bohemian culture of that day. Like the Greenwich, Athens was the Greenwich Village of the ancient Greek world, or the Haight-Ashbury, or the, you know, whatever it is in Seattle. There, thank you. That the cultural, the bohemian cultural center, where the kind of out on the edge, cutting edge cultural forces of the intelligentsia and the cultural elite are doing their thing and are creating their own subculture. And I think the reason you have the feel that you do in the Platonic dialogues is because it probably was relatively commonplace in the world that Plato inhabits and in that subculture. It probably was relatively commonplace, but it's only a subculture. It's commonplace in San Francisco, too. But San Francisco is not America. It's its own unique little cross-section. In the modern world, we used to take it for granted that homosexuality was immoral until a bunch of things began to come together, a bunch of cultural forces began to overlap with one another. The first thing that happened is, and whether this was an orchestrated propaganda campaign or whether it just happened, I don't know. But the world, most of the modern world, became persuaded that homosexuals were genetically determined to be homosexuals. We saw news report after news report about some guy in LA who found that homosexual males who died had a bigger part of their brain, part of their brain was bigger than or smaller or something like that than heterosexual males. As it turns out, that wasn't exactly very valid evidence, but that was reported around the world. And you had all these efforts by the media to try to persuade all of us that when all is said and done, I mean, they can't help it. It's just in their genes. It just comes naturally to homosexuals to be homosexuals. And in other words, that it was no more significant to be oriented sexually to a member of the same sex as it was to be left-handed. It was as innocent, as natural, and as inevitable as that. Well, to the extent that we decided that that was true and that we bought into that picture, to that extent, it became, of course, cruel, unloving, unenlightened, outmoded, old-fashioned, and bigoted to deny of homosexuals the same sort of choices that heterosexuals had. That was the perspective that I think became commonplace in American culture. Now, what changed to allow that to happen? Well, because of the Enlightenment, and on the heels of the Enlightenment, one thing that became a reality in our culture is that whatever else is true, Christianity is not true. So Christianity, of course, had been a huge statement against the morality of homosexuality. But once Christianity was rejected, that's removed and that's out of the picture. And the other side of that coin was, while we were rejecting the truth of Christianity, we were accepting wholesale the philosophical view that we would call naturalism. And what I mean by that is the view that everything, literally everything that happens in the world is a result of electrons and protons and molecules bouncing around and genes and biological forces and so on and so forth. Everything is ultimately reducible to physics. And if everything is ultimately reducible to physics, then if you take that to its logical conclusion, you have a problem with any ethical principle. If we're just a matter of natural forces converging to make happen whatever makes happen, where do we get off calling anything exactly wrong or immoral or making any sort of value judgment at all? Now, typically, the society across the board didn't go that far. You know, they didn't accept naturalism and decide, therefore, there's no valid moral judgments at all that we can make. Rather, they were rather selective about when they decided that a value judgment can't be made. But in the area of homosexuality, there are forces at work in our society to work really hard to say, now here's an area where you shouldn't be passing judgment, moral judgment. The classic manifestation of that was that Seinfeld episode that you may or may not know about, where over and over again in the episode, it comes up that somebody's a homosexual, and immediately they're added, not that there's anything wrong with that. Not that there's anything wrong with that. And it's just a tremendous spoof that's capturing the heart of the problem, is that it was just in the air in our culture at the end of this last century that you don't pass moral judgment on what people do sexually, and especially if that involves homosexuality. There's nothing wrong with it. I may be uncomfortable, I may not like it, I may not prefer it, it may not be my option, it may not be my choice, but I have no business whatsoever saying that it's wrong. And that's what I ran into in my discussion. I wasn't only calling it wrong, I was calling it perverse, and I was a dangerous human being. So, philosophically, Christianity is not true, naturalism is true. In society, the sexual revolution in the 1960s and into the 70s was ultimately a revolution against there being any moral restraint in the realm of sexuality whatsoever. I mean, that's really ultimately what the sexual revolution was all about. It was sold on other terms. It was about freedom and liberty and so on and so forth. But really the freedom that they wanted was freedom from morality, freedom from themselves, freedom from guilt, freedom from any sort of moral judgment on the choices that they made with their sexuality. If you were to go back and study the lyrics of the songs, the popular music of that time, I mean, they really reflect an attitude that if it feels good, do it. There was a relatively popular song that was played on the radio all the time back then. How can anything that feels so good be so wrong? And that it's no accident. That captured the spirit of how everybody was thinking about things back then. But back in the 60s and 70s, still, sex was still seen as connected to some kind of relationship. You had sex with people you were in love with back then, and that was just taken for granted. Sex and love went together. There shouldn't be any restraints on sex other than it should be with somebody you love. But beyond that, it was taken for granted. It was just assumed that you would only be open to having sexual relations with someone that you loved. That's changing, it seems to me. The modern world is increasingly embracing homosexual practice now on entirely different grounds. Not on the grounds that it's genetically determined, but on the grounds that the valid employment of our sexuality, I'm sorry, that I can do whatever I want with my sexuality, and that's a valid grounds for how I behave sexually, is just doing whatever I want. Still today, more conservative people in our culture still need to be appealed to on the basis of genetic determination, but determinism. Homosexuals can't help it. They are genetically determined to be what they are. But have you noticed how little you hear that anymore? That's not even really the issue any longer. It's a fallback issue in case you're conservative enough and not postmodern enough to be able to appeal to on some other basis. So the fallback argument will be genetic determinism. But we don't even need to bring that up. In fact, I read a very, very interesting book about 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago now. No, probably 20 years ago, called The Gene Myth. It was written by a very radical feminist lesbian geneticist. And her concern was, she had two concerns. One, as a scientist and as a geneticist, she realized how bogus the mythology about homosexuality being genetically determined was. Because the only thing genes do is give you a recipe for making amino acids. They don't make you say anything. They don't make you do anything. They don't determine much of anything in our lives. They can have some influence on some behaviors, but they don't have the power to make us do anything. And that's the point that she's making. I didn't see it, but my brother is telling me about a program on OPB, a series of programs by is it Fukuyama is a geneticist, and he did a series of series on OPB, all kinds of studies with rats and the genetic what is genetically determined in rats, and the incredible thing was how much freedom rats have from their genes, the thing that you saw in that program. If you thwart them in one way, then they learn a new behavior, no matter what the genetic realities of their little lives are. The genes just aren't that powerful. Scientists know that, but it's the cultural myth that genes are like these little computer programs in us that dictate to the nth detail how we're going to behave and how we're going to think and what we're going to feel and who we're going to be and so on. But it just ain't true. It's not right. But her concern, one, on the one hand, was a scientist. On the other hand, her concern was, we know what happened in Nazi Germany when people thought that behaviors that they didn't like were linked to genes. So do we in the homosexual community, do we really want our choices, our behavior, our lifestyle linked to genes? All you need is one person to come along who decides he wants to rid society of this behavior, and we're going to have an extermination program. This is a dangerous direction that we're going in. I don't know if her voice was heard or not, but it is very interesting how little you hear that argument being made anymore. But on the other hand, you don't need to, because the world has become more postmodern even than it was back in the sexual revolution. And now it seems to me that we have another step in philosophy. We've gone one step further. Not beyond naturalism, we have rejected the whole idea that anything in the cosmos is what philosophers would call teleological. The cosmos is not a teleological cosmos. Now, what that means is it used to be commonplace in the ancient world. It has been commonplace throughout the whole history of Christian philosophy and Christian theology through the Enlightenment. It was commonplace with the advance of modern science and so on. It has been commonplace to think of the universe as operating as a structure that's been designed. It has purposes. It has mechanisms in it that are for a reason and accomplish what they're intended to accomplish and so on. Even long after philosophers have abandoned the idea that there is a designer of the universe, they have still nonetheless argued, but it's very helpful scientifically to observe it and study it for its design as if it were designed. Even though we know, of course, it's not designed because there is no designer, but nonetheless, it's fruitful to operate under that assumption and study it and figure out what it is. Well, today, philosophically, our culture has abandoned that idea. So when it comes to sexuality, there is no structure to our sexuality. There's no purpose for it. There's no intrinsic nature to human sexuality. All we are the animals that we are, and we can do whatever we want to do with our sexuality. There's no right, no wrong, no normal or abnormal, no natural or unnatural. Whatever I do with my sexuality is what I do with my sexuality, and it's all valid and it's all okay. Society then, at the same time, has shifted its attitude towards sex. Sex has now been converted into a drug and form of recreation that is completely and totally disconnected from relationship. Now no longer in the emerging culture do you need to love someone to have sex with them. That's sort of old-fashioned. Sex is nothing more and nothing less than this experience, encounter that I can have for largely recreational purposes. And for many people, I'll talk more about this a little bit next week, but for many people it's become sort of a drug of choice, with all of the problems that attach to drugs. So love has nothing to do with sex. Sex has become something to experiment with. And it seems to me that the direction of our cultural development has made a lie out of the whole premise behind accepting homosexuality to begin with, namely the widespread practice of bisexuality. Well, what, is there a third gene? A bisexuality gene? You know, I mean, early on, it was, you can't help yourself. You've got to be what you are. You are oriented the way that you are oriented, and you're going to be oriented one way or the other. But I think our culture has made a lie out of all that stuff. It's shown us that this is about fashion, about fad, about recreational choice, about individual human choice. We do what we want to do, and we gravitate toward what we've chosen to gravitate toward. Okay, well, what is the truth? The truth is, I think, that Christianity is true, the Bible is true, and the biblical perspective on homosexuality is the truth, and the biblical perspective on homosexuality is that it is indeed a perversion of what the designer of human sexuality intended. I'll talk about that in a second. Second thing that's true is that natural law is a valid perspective. I think that follows from a biblical worldview. From a biblical worldview, it follows that at least to a certain extent, we are able to take certain cues from nature and know what God intended just by looking at the structure of nature itself. So we can learn something about human sexuality just by studying and observing the nature of human sexuality. And what I will argue is that natural law, nature itself, suggests that heterosexuality is intended and homosexuality is not. Homosexuality is an aberration. It does not fit with nature. And then, just as importantly, from a biblical perspective, sexuality is something that needs to be restrained for moral reasons. Right. So that has implications not just for homosexuality, but it has implications for all of our sexual practices and all of our orientations toward our sexuality. We need to restrain the passions and impulses that may be in us in favor of answering the question, what's right, what's good, what's true, what's appropriate, and inform our behavior by what's appropriate. So let's start by looking at the biblical case for homosexuality. And I won't go into a lengthy discussion. I don't think I need to. Probably most of you don't need to be persuaded. But do you mind reading Leviticus 18:22?
Okay.
And we're going to look at Leviticus 20 after that.
You shall not lie with a male as one lies with a female. It is an abomination.
Okay. And then 20:13.
If there is a man who lies with a male as those who lie with a woman, both of them have committed a detestable act. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood guiltness is upon them.
Okay, good. So oftentimes when you get into an argument with people about homosexuality in the Bible, the claim that they will make is when the Bible teaches against homosexuality, it's really not homosexual practice that it is forbidding and calling an abomination and calling wrong, but it's some kind of temple prostitution or some kind of idolatry. It's this practice that's associated with the worship of a false god, and that's why it's an abomination, not because it is a matter of males lying with males and so on. But what's interesting about those Leviticus passages is, it seems to me, it is as clear as they could possibly have made it, that the abomination is a male lying with a male as with a woman. That's the abomination. And in both of those passages, that's the case. Now, the argument that people will give you at that point is if you say, look, the Mosaic Covenant said that homosexuality was wrong, it prohibited homosexual practice, they'll say, well, it also prohibited eating pigs and all kinds of stuff that we don't honor, we don't respect, we don't accept that part of the law any longer. I think homosexuality should be thrown out as a prohibition, just like this other stuff should be thrown out. Well, good point, up to a point, in that it is not a foregone conclusion that just because something is in the Mosaic Covenant, that it is therefore a moral offense, that it is therefore something that is universally across all cultures wrong. That's true. That's a valid point. So when we use the Mosaic Covenant, we have to look at each and one of those prohibitions and make a determination. Why was this one prohibited? Was this one prohibited because God wanted the Jews to be a peculiar and weird people, and this is one of the ways he was going to make them a peculiar and weird people? Or was this a prohibition because it's just flat out ungodly? It's just flat out wrong behavior, and God didn't want his people to engage in ungodly and wrong behavior? Or whatever else the reason might be. Was it something that was particular and only pertained to this unique covenant that God was making with Israel? Or did this happen to be one of those prohibitions that has transcultural relevance? Well, how would we know that? We'd know that in one of two ways. Some things are obviously moral, and we know that they're obviously moral in nature because the moral vision behind it just naturally and spontaneously resonates with us. You know, murder, killing people. I think it's just cultural. You know, I think other cultures ought to be able to kill people. But the Jews, God wanted them to be kind of weird and didn't want them killing each other, so he prohibited murder. We know just because as rational human beings, we're not clueless about morality. We have a sense of what it means to be good. Jesus appealed to that sense, remember? One way of kind of summing up morality is to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. One very, very important litmus test about whether something is good behavior is put yourself in their shoes and ask, do I want and would I like to be treated that way? If not, then don't treat them that way. Because I already just rationally, through my own knowledge and experience, have a sense of the difference between good and bad, right and wrong. So we can apply that sense. A second matter is, if we in fact can draw any conclusions from natural law, we can appeal to natural law. Could it be that homosexuality is forbidden because it's like unnatural? Well, let's go to nature and look. Let's inquire of natural law whether or not homosexuality seems to pass muster by that standard. And then there's a third way we can tell, and that is, how did the New Testament look at it? What was their perspective? Because we have all kinds of examples of the apostles going back to certain features of the Mosaic Covenant and saying, well, that doesn't apply anymore. That's obsolete. I mean, you don't want to be going back to that. Don't practice that, because you miss the whole point if you practice that. That was for them, not for us, right? The Sabbath, the dietary regulations, circumcision, certain festivals and feast days, all kinds of things where the apostles explicitly renounced making your life about those things, because those are only shadows of things to come. And the thing to come has already come, and so we don't need to stay within the shadows. We can believe and hope in and base our life on the reality instead of the shadows. Well, what do we find when we go to the apostles? Not only do they not say, now that homosexuality thing, that thing about males lying with males like females, that was for the Jews. That's not for us. Let's not bother ourselves with that prohibition any longer. That's obsolete. You don't have them say anything like that. Not only do you not have them say anything like that, you have them affirming and ratifying the prohibition. In two places in particular, in Romans 1, 26 and 27, for example. I have a Bible now. My goodness, you have a lot of introductory notes. For this reason, God gave them over to vile passions, for even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise, also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust for one another, men with men committing what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error, which was due. And 1 Corinthians 6:9 is a list of people who will not inherit the kingdom of God. And on that list with murderers and thieves and so on and swindlers and so on are homosexuals. They will not inherit the kingdom of God. Now, you put all those things together. Before I put those together, what's the natural law case against homosexuality? Well, I think very simply, it doesn't need to be spelled out. We can understand certain aspects of God's purpose and design for sexuality from the physical facts about human anatomy and human physiology. And what we would learn, I think, by looking at human anatomy and human physiology is that God had something very specific in mind for human sexuality. Not only did he intend it for reproduction of other little human critters, on the one hand, but it's very distinctive and different, even at a physiological level, from animal sexuality, because it's not only for procreation, but it certainly includes procreation as inextricably bound up together with sexuality. And everything about our anatomy suggests that man and woman were made for each other. It seems to me that to escape that conclusion, you have to reject the very idea of natural law as such, as a valid source of knowledge. I mean, once you allow that there's anything that we could read off of nature, then it seems to me an inescapable conclusion. So people, in order to avoid that conclusion, will just kind of dismiss and poo-poo the whole idea of natural law altogether, which is very commonplace in our society today. Note that in the Romans 1 passage, Paul actually alludes to a natural law kind of argument. I'll read that again. For this reason, God gave them over up to vile passions, for even their women exchanged the natural use, in the Greek it's literally that which is against nature, for the natural use of what is against, for what is against nature. Likewise, also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust for one another, men with men committing what is shameful and receiving themselves a penalty for their error. So he even explicitly makes the point that this is against the natural order. So you put all those things together. The apostles affirmed their prohibitions. They didn't in any way qualify them or reject them or consider them obsolete. They made their own natural law case and affirmed the use of natural law in rejecting them. And whatever sense we have about, well, I guess I can't make that case because that's culturally formed enough that maybe we have been influenced by our culture enough that we don't have any sense within us that resonates with the wrongness of homosexuality. Some of us may, but some of us in our culture may not. But on those other two accounts, it seems quite clear that when God prohibits it in the Mosaic Covenant, it was because it was immoral, not because it was a part of their religion. One of the objections that gets raised by homosexuals or defenders of homosexuals is that, especially homosexuals referring to their own experience, will often anecdotally say, I cannot remember a time in my life when I was not attracted to members of the same sex. My homosexual feelings go back so early in my life, I can't remember a time when that was not my orientation. And I think what they're trying to argue by that is, this is natural to me. This is what nature has dictated for me, and behind that is an assumption that it's in my genes. So get off my back, don't bug me, don't be a bigot. It's in my genes, leave me alone. The problem with that kind of evidence is, I mean, turn that to other things in our life. I can't remember a time in my life when I wasn't a liar and a thief. So what's that mean? I mean, can you go back far enough that you can remember a time where you wouldn't have been tempted to steal that which was not yours if you wanted it enough? Can you ever remember a time in your life where you wouldn't have been tempted to tell an untruth in order to protect you from uncomfortable or uncertain circumstances? I mean, don't both of those things come as naturally as anything to us? Even if we don't succumb to them, we understand the pull, the temptation to those things. And from our earliest days, we understand the temptation to those things. It was astonishing to me how quickly my kids learned to lie. But I don't even have to look at my own kids. I mean, what about me? I'm not sure what it's supposed to prove. It either proves that it was natural that I'm a homosexual, or it proves that I was perverse really early on, which is exactly what we all experience and we all know and we all understand. Yes, I have been perverse for as long as I can remember. I have been willing to be a twisted human being who acts the way human beings really ought not to act, and that's been true for my whole life. Just a couple of comments about making a distinction in our culture between the culture and the practice of male homosexuality on the one hand and lesbianism on the other hand. I think this is changing. I mean, the whole world is changing. Things are changing rapidly. But when homosexuality first began to be accepted in our society, there was a significant distinction between the culture of the gay culture and the lesbian culture. What drove male homosexuality was very different than what drove female homosexuality. And I think the reason for that is, in one way, it's a kind of perverse kind of evidence for the fact that males and females experience their sexuality differently. It doesn't mean exactly the same thing in the same way to a male as it does to a female. Lesbian homosexuality early on was pretty much about relationships. It tended to be monogamous. It tended to be relatively long-term. It tended to, in large measure, downplay the actual physicality of sexuality to a large extent. Male homosexuality, on the other hand, was not long-term at all. In the early stages, it was incredibly promiscuous. The sex was anonymous. You didn't even know who your partner was, who your sex partner was, because it wasn't about people. It wasn't about relationships. It wasn't about connecting with another human being. It was really about nothing other than the drug of it, the sexual pleasure itself of it, and the drug high that would result from that. That seems to be changing as. And this is partly the impact, I would imagine, of pornography in our culture. But it's everybody is becoming sexualized, male and female. We men, even in our perversion, always find a way to beat up on you women. We always conform you to our values. And that seems to be happening in pornography and in the sex culture, in the sex business, is that we're turning everyone into a drug addict fascinated with the physical aspects of sexual pleasure. So lesbianism, I think, is becoming less monogamous and less long-term, going from relationship to relationship, just imitating the men more and more. What's the antidote to all this? Well, I wish I had a magic answer, an answer that would solve this problem easily and painlessly, but I'm afraid that I don't know of any such thing. It seems to me that there's just simply two things that we need to learn, and we need to learn them well, and we need to learn them deeply, and we need to let them be burnt, etched on our souls, indelibly on our souls. And that is, we need to understand the truth about the nature and purpose of human sexuality, know it and believe it. Know it and believe it against all the mythology and the lies that are coming at us and are that we are barraged with every day. I mean, the songs we listen to, the movies we watch, the television shows we watch, every message coming at us is coming at us out of a perspective that sex is recreational. Sex is just there to be enjoyed. And there is no real meaning or purpose to it. We can do with it whatever we want to do with it. And boy, am I having fun with my sexuality. Too bad about you. I mean, just that's the message that we're confronted with all the time. And if we are not firmly committed to the idea that the Bible knows better than all those other voices that are speaking at me, then we're lost, it seems to me. Because they come at us in so many compelling and seductively attractive sorts of ways. So we simply have to decide that the Bible knows what it's talking about. The truth is the truth. And I want my life to line up with what's true, not with all this fantasy, this fiction, this mythology that is informing the rest of the world. And then secondly, fostering self-control. Even the whole idea of self-control is an old-fashioned idea by the standards of our culture. But it's a crucial, it was crucial in the ancient world among the pagans. I mean, even they understood this. We're not even as good as the old-fashioned pagans anymore. And it's certainly true in Christianity that I am a moral and rational and spiritual creature made in the image of God. I'm not an animal. And therefore, regardless of the fact that I may have impulses in me that are more animal-like, the fact that they are an impulse is not some sort of validation for acting on them. I need to ask myself the question, but is it good? Does it make sense? Is it a rational behavior? And is it in keeping with what God wants me to do and what God wants me to be? By living my life in the light of those questions and the answers to those questions, that's the only way I know how to fortify myself into becoming a creature that exercises self-control. I'm committed to doing what I'm supposed to do, not necessarily what I want to do, not necessarily what I'm drawn to do. And fostering that kind of self-control, it seems to me, is a crucial part of the antidote. Let me just make one last comment, and then I'll open it up to you for discussion and your questions. One of the things that did happen out of the sexual revolution, that there's a good aspect of this, and that is it puts in perspective homosexual sin. I think it really is true that earlier in our culture, homosexuals were looked on as, you know, I think the sting of the word perverse for people when they feel the sting of that is it somehow implies to them subhuman or, you know, different in some kind of way that makes you that all of us are practicing and that all of us evidence in our lives and manifest in our lives. So we need to get off of our moral high horse and not look down on homosexuality as somehow a greater, graver, more heinous sin than the rest of them. The fact of the matter is, no, it's not more heinous than any other sin. It's just one more manifestation of our rebellion against God, our rebellion against truth, our rebellion against everything good. But it's just one more manifestation. But so is my self-centeredness, and so is my pride, and so is my self-righteousness, and so is all that other garbage in my life. So I'm no better off than they are. We're all in need of the mercy of God, and I really need to be clear about that. So to try to raise that question and kind of blunt the edge of the self-righteousness and the hypocrisy with which much of Christian society met homosexuality is one of the few good things probably that's come out of this. Okay, I can't think of anything else right now, so let me open it up to your comments or questions. Or
what do you say to those people who say that homosexuality is a worser sin, in a sense, because you're choosing to live in sin, whereas all these other sins you're talking about, your self-righteousness, your anger, whatever your issue is something you're consciously fighting against, whereas homosexuality, if you're choosing to live in it, you're accepting that it's a sin that you've made a choice to live in.
Well, there may be some truth in that. I mean, that's not unique, of course, to homosexuality. That would be just as true of many manifestations of heterosexuality as well. It's that distinction that John makes in the end of 1 John. There's a sin unto death and a sin that's not unto death. And I think it is true that sometimes when I make a deliberate lifestyle choice that I know flies in the face of everything that Jesus stands for example, that I can't make a decision for this without making a decision against Jesus. And in that sense, yeah, I mean, it could be a damning sin in that sense, and therefore worse. That's more true of people who are more, I think the more we advance in this, the more we become degenerate in this culture, and the more people have experience with homosexuality as just a natural course of their lives, the less true that's going to be, in the sense that they may very well be involved in homosexual relationships without ever having made that deliberate choice against Jesus in order to do so. That they will come, I think, in their lives. I mean, that issue will confront them eventually, but I don't think it's a foregone conclusion. But for someone like me, coming out of the background that I came out of, it's just unthinkable that I could have chosen the homosexual lifestyle without that involving a rejection of everything that I knew that was true.
I have another question. I have a very good couple friends who are a lesbian couple who don't have sex, and their relationship isn't about sex. It's probably because they're Christians, and so they feel like that's the part of a homosexual relationship that's wrong. But they have been happily married for 10-plus years and have a 5-year-old daughter and are probably better parents than a lot of parents I've ever seen. So how do you respond to people like that, where they're acknowledging that the sexual side of a relationship in a same-sex relationship is wrong, but they're not acknowledging that the relationship is wrong?
Wow. And, okay. It's difficult to answer that because it's difficult to know at what level might they be confused there. The fact that they choose to define it as a marital kind of relationship suggests to me that it probably ultimately is wrong. It's to their credit that they have had enough scruples to make it not a sexual relationship, assuming that's true. It's to their credit that they have the scruples to not do that, because they are conscientiously trying to follow their Lord in that respect. But nonetheless, it seems to me that part of this natural law and part of the revelation of the scriptures suggests that marriage is a man to a woman. And so to the extent that they're rebelling against that and deciding they want to reinvent that and allow that to be a marriage of a woman to woman is in fact an act of rebellion as well. But I don't know what kind of pain lies behind that. And I mean, that's almost always the case, is that there's a great, especially within lesbianism, both. There's a lot of pain that lies behind the choice that they've made. They don't any longer want to face the inconvenience, the hassle, the sorrow, the suffering, and the grief that comes from doing it God's way. It seems more attractive to reinvent another institution that doesn't bring the same sorrow.
Right. They both agreed that they wouldn't raise a child with a man because man is... Every man that they've ever known is too corrupt.
Yeah.
So, makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
how should we as Christians relate to homosexuals? Going back to Summer's question, it seems like you were saying that homosexuality in God's eyes is no greater sin than, say, self-righteousness. So, theoretically, we should be no more repulsed by someone who's homosexual than someone who's a Christian who's self-righteous. So,
or another way of putting it would be just as repulsed.
Okay.
I don't think there's anything wrong with being repulsed by it. We should be repulsed by lying and deception and self-righteousness. I mean, we should become sensitized to those things, not desensitized to those things. But we then need to be merciful and patient toward them, just as we want and are merciful and patient toward ourselves, just as our Lord is merciful and patient toward us, and we need to extend that same thing to them. But I would, but you know, with having qualified it in that way, I would treat them just like I would any other human sinner. They're no different, and that's really true. I mean, the more you see homosexuals, they're not weird. They're just human beings who've made rebellious choices against God. What's new? And that's pretty normal.
So in that respect, would it be okay to vote yes on those measures that are... Because I know I'm drawn to, just because, yeah. Generally speaking, homosexual men make better friends than a lot of straight men for women. So I want to see them get their rights just as much as I want to see anyone get their rights. So would that be okay?
I think you can make a case for it. My problem with those measures is not... I mean, that's what I was trying to say back so many years ago, is that I really don't have a problem if you want to mercifully grant health insurance to another person in the world, if you as an employer want to. Or there's all kinds of... I mean, I don't... There's no merit in punishing people for their rebellious choices against God. I mean, any more than you would punish any other group of people for their rebellious choices against God. The problem, the real problem for me, is that laws have a tendency to validate things by putting it in concrete, by making an ordinance, by making it acceptable. Laws are not the only thing that do this. That's what irritates me to no end about the jokes and the sitcoms and all the other stuff on television. It takes these realities and normalizes them just by familiarizing it, just by making them commonplace and by making them mundane. They tend to validate them by objectifying them in our culture and just making them a fixture. And that's what I have the bigger problem with. The reason I have a problem with this current ordinance in Eugene about allowing you to register same-sex relationships and stuff is that you're having all the force and objectivity of the city government saying it's perfectly all right, it's perfectly valid. And I think that can't help but have devastating implications on the long term for our society. So that's why I would vote no, is for the symbolic value of those things, not because I want to punish anybody or hurt them.
Yeah, I think... one of the things I've struggled with the most ever since my youngest brother told our family he was gay, I've just gone through a lot of anger and stuff. It was good for me to see myself doing that and about him as a person who I love very much. But it's like at first, he didn't share this with our family. We'd always been close. Then it was like when it came out, so, you know, it was almost like this challenge. Well, do you still love me? How do we, you know, still interact and everything? And now, as society really, you know, this is so acceptable, it's like, I think it's very clear that we all still love each other. And he knows where, like, my parents and I stand on, you know, we don't think this is right, what he's doing. But there's just, anymore, there isn't the forum for this, even talking about our struggle, because we get together and, oh, you know, we all love and support each other. But it's almost like, I don't know, how do you stop culture from rolling over you? I see that just generally and in our family context. He and I sometimes email back and forth and have kind of serious talks, but it's really hard to, it's almost like, well, what's the use anymore? It seems like from his standpoint, he's been proving to our family all these years that he's basically a normal person and is in a long-term relationship with someone. And, I don't know. Am I just wanting to, I wonder sometimes if I'm just wanting to bring up conflict that's unnecessary. And I don't anyway. So then I wonder if I'm too soft on my brother. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's confusing.
There's a tremendous temptation that we all face. That's to ostracize people. In the Amish communities, they have their institution of shunning. They have simply institutionalized what every church does, but at least they have the courage to call it what it is. Out of good motives, we want people saved. We want people sanctified. We want people to love what's good and to love what's right. But the problem is, we as human beings are free. And we can go our own way, and we can define our own lives and define our own existence, and no one can really tell us who to be and what choices to make. But that's not acceptable to us, especially when it's our children or our siblings or people that we're really close to and we really love. We don't want them to go destroy their lives. So we reach out for something that I can do to try to protect them and keep them safe and make sure that they follow the right path. And so we are sorely tempted to use some form of social ostracism, some kind of punitive measures, to say, if you go the wrong way, you're going to be punished for it by me or by us as a community or whatever. And the thing we really need to understand is that works to a degree. In some contexts, you can gain a great deal of social conformity among people if you make the social consequences severe enough. But what we have to understand is that doesn't sanctification make. If people have not freely chosen their path, then they're not choosing it authentically. What they're really choosing is to conform. They're not choosing goodness. They're choosing to conform to our standards so that they don't pay the consequences. And that parents need to understand that with respect to their children. We need to understand that with respect to our siblings. We need to understand it with respect to our friends. Is that we don't really, in the end, gain anything by getting in their face and making sure they know how unhappy I am with their choice or their behavior. One of the most ironic things in human existence is the people. I'm talking especially parents and children right now. The people who care about me the most, namely my parents, are the people who are in the worst position to be able to tell me anything when it comes to important issues like this. And oftentimes the same is true of siblings. The people who have the most interest in me, in my well-being, in my welfare, oftentimes are muzzled by the very relationship itself. They're not going to listen to me. Because I'm just the brother, or I'm just the sister. You almost have to say, God, send somebody. Send somebody to listen to. It's hard. That's where it's real test of our faith is, do I really believe that there is a God there who is committed to them and who can sanctify them without me?
Yeah, it seems like the best thing in my relationship with him just over the years has been to just let him know that I do love him very much. And mm-hmm. And I guess that's all I can do.
Yeah. And as scary as it is to think, I mean, what we think is my loving you is going to be interpreted as validating your choice. And that's what we're afraid is going to happen. But in my experience, they know when I don't agree. And it speaks, in the end, it speaks more and better to go ahead and love them and be silent about their choice because my very presence is speaking loudly about what I think of their choice. And they'll decide what they're going to do with that.
I really tried to wait to make sure there's no one else who had possibly had a question. I just deal with this a lot because a lot of my connections are homosexual friends. Anyway, I just had a question. How do you respond to, like, your response in loving and not and being and remaining silent is all fine and good, but it's really difficult when that is their life. Like, my closest friend in Seattle just decided she's lesbian. That is her life. She literally cannot go through a sentence without that being evident in her sentence. So it's really hard to just remain silent. I mean, you can't not respond. You can't just sit there and be silent continuously, but you also can't be continuously negative. So I guess I'm wondering how you respond without validating the choice that they're making, but and continuing to love them, but also not being demeaning or putting down them as a human being, but at the same time not saying, well, I'm glad you're happy and I'm glad you're... I mean, because I find myself stopping myself from saying so many things to her that I would love to say, you know, like, I can't say I'm glad you're happy. I'm not. I can't say, I'm, you know, you look like you're doing a lot better than you've been doing. I don't think that's true. I mean, so much communication and so much of what we would normally relate to each other on is gone because everything is about this freedom of choice that she has now decided she has. Mm-hmm. So... Where's a medium? What do you talk about? I mean, how do you talk when that's your worldview? That's her worldview, is now that lesbianism is a valid, you know, rational, good choice for her in her life. And it's going to show in everything she does now.
Well, you know, of course, something that drastically different, that choice is the kind of thing that can create so much distance that eventually you may find there isn't much you can talk about. You're going to probably have to really work to keep some sort of common ground. I'm just thinking out loud here, but can you do an end run around the homosexuality issue and seek to get her to see the same important things in other areas of her life? I mean, would she be open to, in some context where she's talking about a relationship, for example, not talk about the homosexuality, but talk about lack of patience, selfishness, self-centeredness, pride, self-righteousness.
Within
all that
the relationship
other stuff.
Or within herself?
Well, within herself, but using the circumstances of her life to bounce off of. The main thing is that all of us need to confront the reality of our own moral unworthiness. And there's this glaring place where she could see it, but that's probably the last place that she's going to see it. So rather than have her look at that, can she look at some other stuff that's also manifestations of that? Because I think that's where there would be hope in her life if she can come to recognize the reality of her moral unworthiness and the answer that is found in Jesus for that. And this will take care of itself if she can deal with those issues.
I think, unfortunately, that a lot of homosexuality is wrapped up in those issues of...
Right.
Self-centeredness and self-righteousness, and I know for her personally, like, her choice came out of she felt she was doing what God wanted her to do all her life and denying who she was. And then she just decided she was not going to deny who she was anymore and pursue this. So it's really difficult for me to perceive how a conversation would work of any self-reflection, because right now everything is about freedom of self. Everything is about, I'm now going to be this person that I think I should be, which is essentially a complete sinner. I mean,
right.
But she's accepted that as, this is what's right for me because it's who I am. So they're so tightly wrapped in each other that it's really hard for me to see how it would ever...
Yeah, I see the problem. Do you have an answer?
It just seems to me that a new convert to anything requires a lot of patience.
Yeah.
Including us.
And time.
Huh? And time. Yeah, that's what I mean by patience. I mean, most of us that have become Christians came in it and beat people over the head with our Bibles and said all sorts of obnoxious things and a lot of things we regret that we did with loved ones and that kind of stuff. And I think what's going to be required on your part is just patience. And she's going to be a flaming whatever at this point for a while. We have all been flaming whatevers in a lot of areas of our lives, new ideas, new theologies, new, you know, whatever. That's just going to take time.
But everything that goes up comes down.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. So.
It's just unfortunate that an entire culture is flaming. I mean, in a lot of senses, flaming. And so she has a lot of...
Yeah, there's a lot of political clout.
Right. To be that way. The flame doesn't die real fast.
Very well.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay, I don't either, so... change the subject quick so that my ignorance is not so obvious.
Well, I was thinking, and Summer touched on this a little bit, but I was thinking about how I agree and I appreciate what you've said about that really none of us are less of a sinner than somebody who is a homosexual. And we all have our sins. And even in our repentance, even if we are repentant in our sins, I'm sure there's, you know, a lot, a big part of us that's not repentant and that is rebellious. But I also see, especially in a new convert, as Terry said, of anything, it seems that if a person is coming out of the closet as a homosexual, they are, like you said, you know, in rebellion against some biblical truths. Not to say that we're not, or that we are less of a sinner, but the direction can be different. Not that we are God and that we are the ones that need to decide that. And I think it's true that we do need to have patience, but
yeah,
it's hard.
I don't want you to misunderstand, and there's a difference between belief and unbelief, a huge difference, between light and darkness difference. And what we find in our culture with gay pride and the glorying in this perversion, I mean, that's just the epitome of rebellion against God and unbelief. It's what Paul is describing in Romans 1 as not only do they do such things, but they, how's he put it? Give something approval to those who do so. I mean, we applaud this perversion in our culture. I mean, certain segments of this culture. Well, that's damnable. I mean, that's why people go to hell, is for that kind of thing. That's not what I mean by we're just as bad off as they are. Well, no. By the grace of God, we have had our eyes open to realize that sin is sin and perversion is perversion. And yes, I am sinful and yes, I am perverse, but God save me. Well, the fact that I would take the attitude, God, who I am is awful, God save me and be merciful, rather than shaking my fist at God and saying I'm a homosexual, what are you going to do about it? I mean, those are night and day, and we have to recognize that.
Yeah, and that, I guess that's what and I know that you weren't saying anything different than that, but it's just, it makes it harder, I think, if a person in any area is proud about being rebellious about something.
Right.
It's hard to relate if we are hoping not to be rebellious.
Right. Exactly.
But we're not better.
No. Yeah.
Jack, I just wanted to get back to the scripture where you, the passage in the New Testament where you talked about, or where it spoke about those who, though they will not inherit the kingdom of...
Right, the First Corinthians.
First Corinthians.
You want me to expand on that more?
Yes, please.
I mean, the obvious question about that passage, and if I don't get your question, let me know, but the obvious question about that is, what exactly do you mean, Paul? Do you mean if I have practiced homosexuality or if I have engaged in homosexual practice, can I not enter the kingdom of God? No, that's not what he's saying. I think he's looking at these categories as, you know, it's swindlers, thieves, homosexuals, murderers, whatever. I think he's talking about these attributes as people who are defining their lives by these things. If your life is defined by these things such that you can say you are this and this is your identity, and what would go along with that, I think, would be this kind of glorying in it somehow or justifying it somehow. I think those are people who will not inherit the kingdom of God. If in weakness I steal and then say, God, forgive me, I'm not a thief in the sense that he's talking about it, because I'm ready and willing to repent of and repudiate my own thievery. If I lie and deceive someone and yet I'm contrite, then I'm not a swindler. I'm not a deceiver. It's not the character of my life. In fact, the character of my life is to repudiate the very thing that I've done. I think that's the sense in which he means it.
I have a question. As you said before, the natural argument has pretty much been totally eliminated.
Rejected.
From arguments. So really all we have left then is biblical morality then, as, and if people aren't accepting that as any kind of worthy thing to read or to base your life on, then there really isn't any basis to talk about the validity of an action or not an action.
Well, if people would actually be willing to dialogue with you, the natural, you could still resurrect the natural argument. You need to be ready. I mean, I remember a discussion I heard once where, what does nature teach? Well, I saw some homosexuality among monkeys once, so I guess it's natural. Well, what do we mean by nature? I mean, no example from the animal kingdom is at all relevant to a natural law argument if we're talking about human sexuality. The issue is, what is human sexuality, not as what is monkey sexuality? That's a whole different question. And it really doesn't make any difference how animals employ their sexuality. The question is, what is human sexuality made for in the natural law argument? And so then it would become a question of human anatomy, human psyche, what is natural to the human psyche, and so on and so forth. And it would take some fairly sophisticated argumentation and research and observation and examination to really make that case. But I think intuitively, if we haven't already rejected it out of hand, intuitively, I think it's clear where the conclusion is going to go. But to take someone who's skeptical, it's going to take a much more sophisticated argument, I think. But I think it could be done.
My other question is, there are things that humans do that are occasionally praiseworthy.
That are what?
Occasionally praiseworthy. Occasionally.
Things that humans do?
Yes.
Okay.
Occasionally done out of a pure motive, occasionally.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe close to one, or close to self-sacrificing, occasionally. And homosexuals can do that in areas just as often.
Oh, sure, sure.
And my last question is...
Well, let me back up for a second.
Okay.
I mean, I think you qualified it way too much. Not only occasionally, I think human beings are so much in the image of God that the only time we don't act out of sort of decency and kindness and nobility of some kind is when it gets in our way. The tragedy is that we would ever opt to not be loving, kind, decent, humble, etc., etc., because that's what we were made for. Why would we ever deviate from that? That's the tragedy. That's our corruption. That's our fallenness, is that something can trump that, namely my own self-centeredness and convenience and fear and stuff can trump that. But no, I think you find people doing all kinds of kind and good and decent things to each other all the time. But we're made for that. Why shouldn't we? That's why we were created, is to be those kinds of creatures.
My last question, when you were talking about how, when we were about ostracizing people and how we should avoid that, and that, I'm just curious then about how that then goes with laws that might hinder or hurt homosexual people and their experiences. I mean, not, I mean, they perceive it as hindering and hurting them. And I'm just concerned, I'm just curious too about, you're talking about how you see the long-term consequences of laws, and I just would like to hear more about that if you have a moment.
Well, if you had a law that actually was hindering and hurting a group of people, then yeah, I'd have a, I have a problem with that. I mean, what, I don't know. Well, I guess I should be more clear. If you're hindering people from doing socially destructive criminal activity, yeah, they should be hindered. But if you're just hindering people from doing, boy, this gets complicated. Let me put it this way. I don't think homosexuals should be punished by our laws for being homosexuals. The problem with the debates about those measures in Oregon is, for the most part, there are laws on the books protecting the human rights of human beings, whether they are, and the laws don't make any distinction between heterosexual and homosexual. So if someone batters a homosexual because they're a homosexual, they would get prosecuted for assault and battery because there's a law in the books against assault and battery, I think. I mean, I hope so. Huh?
I think there's one against hate crimes as well.
Well, now there is, yeah, right. And yeah. In my mind, I have a problem with the law against hate crimes because now you're becoming sort of weirdly totalitarian. I mean, to have a law against my inner disposition towards someone, what isn't enough to... If someone murders somebody and we execute them, to murder someone because they murdered... I mean, to execute someone because they murdered them and hated them too just seems a little weird to me. But I think our laws should be there to protect homosexuals, and they should be enforced in such a way that they are equally protected as anyone else. But I think if that's happening, then you don't need to pass special laws to protect a class of people just because they're a distinctive class of people. And the people who oppose the measure, and I'm sympathetic with that, the people who oppose the measure were wondering what the real agenda was. If there are already laws on the books that are already protecting them, why are we singling them out as a class of people? Is it to validate them as a class of people? Is it to make this lifestyle choice valid? Is that what this is really all about? And I think, frankly, that's what it was really all about. And that's the problem I have with it, is that's the one thing I don't want to grant. I don't want my perversity to be granted by society, and I don't want anybody's perversity to be granted by society. I need to be protected from my own perversity. Don't tell me it's normal. Don't tell me it's good. Don't tell me it's right. Tell me it's wrong, because I need to be reminded of it. Okay. Thank you.